You are listening to Covenant Eyes Radio, helping you to stay pure online. In June 2006, O.R. Leslie was arrested for possession of child pornography. This exposed a great secret he had been keeping for decades. Today we are speaking with O.R. and his wife Brenda, as well as his therapist, Dr. Jim O'Quinn.
They escorted me through the lobby of a major metropolitan hospital. They put me in handcuffs and put me out and put me in a patrol car, and I sat there and started forming every kind of lie that I could think of. I found an attorney, and he said the first thing I needed to do was get in contact with a therapist. So I called the local probation office, and they gave me Dr. O'Quinn's name specifically.
O.R. has heard me say this so much it's almost a cliche. If one image could satisfy, one would have just that single photograph. But it requires picture after picture, video after video, deeper and darker, different, always trying to fill that hole that cannot be filled by that image. And the real insidious part of pornography is how it pretends to provide intimacy. And the reason that folks continue to go deeper and deeper is that intimacy doesn't come, and yet they keep going almost like a slot machine, hoping that it will have that great payoff of intimacy.
He would lie and manufacture reasons why he had to be away from me, and that was before the internet came into play. And then after the internet, he would slip away and spend hours in his office away from me. It took time and energy away from us, precious time that we could have spent together.
Hear the rest of their story today on Covenant Eyes Radio.
On that day, from sin we try to hide.
Okay, O.R., let's start by talking about that day in June 2006 when you were called away from your computer at work. Tell us what happened that day.
I was within 5 minutes of leaving the hospital to jump on a plane and fly back home. And I was packing my computer up, my printer, all those kind of things, and three gentlemen showed up at the door of the workroom that I was working in and said that they were from security and that they had a computer issue in the hospital that they were checking out, and they needed to check my computer out. And I immediately kind of knew that something was up just the way they acted. And they were literally looking for a needle in a haystack, and that somewhere in the hospital they knew that someone was accessing pornography, and in fact what they suspected to be child pornography, and they had an IP address, and that was all they had, and they had been going throughout the hospital. They took my laptop and told me that they were going to check the IP address, and the one fellow said, yeah, that's the IP address, and then they asked me to go into another office, and they posted a sentry basically there, and I waited around, and about 15 minutes later, a uniformed policeman showed up and asked me if I knew why he was there, and I immediately started lying and said I had no idea, and he said, well, you know, there's some stuff on your computer you shouldn't have, and I just continued to lie like I didn't know anything about it, and probably about 20 minutes later, they escorted me through the lobby of a major hospital, metropolitan hospital. I was in a suit. They put me in handcuffs. They were very kind. They covered the handcuffs. They weren't trying to make a spectacle or anything, and put me out and put me in a patrol car, and I sat there and started forming every kind of lie that I could think of, basically that I'd been set up and that somebody had planted that information on my computer. There's just no way I would do that. And I was just literally stunned, and all of a sudden I realized everything was tumbling in on me. And eventually they took me to a holding cell area, started to process me, and I can just sit there and remember sitting in that jail cell and I'll never be able to explain it to anybody because it should have been the worst situation that I'd ever faced in my life. And it was in many ways, but I remember getting a peacefulness come over me, just feeling God's spirit on me, letting me know that life was going to be better and everything was going to be all right. And ultimately, it was. And then I was brought in and interviewed by two detectives. And, you know, it wasn't anything like NYPD Blue where they slap you around or try and trick you, anything. They were very kind, very straightforward, and I invoked my privilege to speak to a lawyer. And then I was taken to the city jail, and I found an attorney, and he said the first thing I needed to do prior to going to trial and everything was to get in contact with a therapist to show that I was recognizing the issue and that I was getting help without being mandated by the court. So I called the local probation office, and they gave me Dr. O'Quinn's name specifically. So then we met about six times before I ended up being sentenced. I thought of every single lie I could have to try and justify myself to Brenda. You know, when I called her and I asked for two calls because I knew I needed to call Brenda, but I needed to call our minister there. And so they were very kind to me, allowed me to call my minister first, and then he was there basically with Brenda when I called Brenda and broke the news to her. I'll let Brenda talk about that.
Sure. Now, Brenda, what you got this call from OR, and what was going through your mind?
Well, it was a real quick call, and I had been waiting all day to hear from him and thought it was unusual that he had not called me. And so when the call came and he told me what was going on, I was just listening in disbelief. I couldn't believe that he would ever be guilty of what they were accusing him of. And I just kind of went into shock. I didn't know where to turn, didn't know who to call or what to do next. It was just, I believed his lies and everything that he was telling me.
So this event was obviously was a major turning point, but and obviously that's not where the story starts. Or I want to kind of rewind a little bit here and talk about how you first started viewing pornography. I'm curious about this path that you took from your first glance all the way up the way through to when you were escorted out of the building in handcuffs.
Well, I can remember being around 10 or 11 years old. I remember my uncle having a stash of magazines by his recliner, and I remember sneaking into his house and taking some of those. And then really the first time that I can remember ever taking possession, I guess in that case I just snuck in the house and looked at them. But the first time I ever took possession of anything like that was a Playboy magazine. And I remember going into the drugstore, and I must have been 15 or something. I remember going around down the aisle about 15 times to make sure there wasn't anyone that knew me before I grabbed the magazine, probably took off on a sprint to the checkout.
Sure.
And was scared that somebody from my church would come up and see me, and then bought that and then ran upstairs. Remember hiding it under my jacket or something, then sprinting upstairs and my mom yelling, why aren't you in a hurry? It's funny, things like that seem like yesterday, but I can remember that. This is like in 1970, 1969 or 70, the pornography theaters used to be called art houses, and an art house opened up in town, and I remember sneaking in there, making up a fake ID so I could get in. So I started going to the porn theater that was there in town, and then I went away to college, and the only porn theater that was in any proximity to Oklahoma City where I went to school was about 40 miles outside of the college campus. So I would borrow somebody's car, again, all the secrecy and the lying, make up some ridiculous lie about why I needed their car, and give them gasoline money, and they'd let me, and I'd borrow their car, and I'd go downtown to Oklahoma City to watch pornography. And then, again, I remember doing the same thing after we got married then. I hid all this for Brenda, you know, and I stopped for a certain amount of time after, you know, immediately when we were married for a little while, but then I got a job, and I remember going from one city to Amarillo, which was like a two-hour drive each way just to watch pornography. And then, you know, pretty much my life of pornography is the life of the pornography industry, the video boost, renting video, the old VHS videotapes, and then I started traveling and going into motels or hotels, and they would have the old dial-up AOL lines and all that kind of thing, and then to the days of high-speed internet, which is where we're at today, which made things so much easier, and I started out on the pornography site where you would pay money, but then I found out about the peer-to-peer networks, which is really where a lot of the pornography is trading, especially illegal pornography, is the peer-to-peer networks is the main area where those where that's exchanged, and that's when it really went downhill for me very quickly as far as the darker and darker pornography and where I crossed the line into illegal pornography and where what I was caught on.
For a lot of people, and Dr. O'Quinn, maybe you can answer this too, and OR, I'd like you to chime in here as well. For a lot of people, this is more than a taboo subject. This is something that is, it's not just not discussed. When it is discussed, it is something that is met with a great deal of disdain. And there is a lot of notions and even confusion around this subject. And because someone, a lot of people don't understand how someone can move from legal pornography to illegal pornography, or specifically child pornography or whatever. And they don't quite understand the connections there. Maybe Dr. O'Quinn, maybe you can chime in here and talk a little about that, especially as it pertains to OR's case, and then in general to other people that you know who've gone down that same path.
Well, generally, what happens is that folks begin to access pornography before they have the emotional capability to interpret it. And the real insidious part of pornography is how it pretends to provide intimacy. And the reason that folks continue to go deeper and deeper is that intimacy doesn't come, and yet they keep going almost like a slot machine, hoping that it will have that great payoff of intimacy, and yet it just masquerades, and that's how pornography is a pretender. And part of the effect of evil is that the person continues to say, well, if I just look at another photograph, it's going to be satisfying, and yet it never is. And with OR, he just was not finding it in pornography, accessed it before his relationship. If you look at why he stopped, it was because he was finding intimacy with Brenda. But when he was on the road, he was looking for intimacy again, and again it was going to be the immediate fix. He was looking at that to fill some holes in his life that he thought that he could fill with pornography, and yet it just wouldn't fit.
For myself, it's not enough just to say no, 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 no. It was to find out what were the holes in my spirit and in my spirituality that needed to be fixed so that I could love enough and love my family and love my Lord enough to stop for those motives rather than just thou shalt not.
When you're looking at an individual, taking them to what is relational wholeness, to let them see that restitution and trust building are part of the steps beyond that initial conversion. And so the therapy model is always insisting on the individual growing within their understanding of what is intimacy and achieving relational wholeness.
Absolutely true. That's sort of foundational to what we're talking about here. How then does someone in this process, this escalation of moving from image to image, from video to video, from swapping and trading in images and these kind of things, how does someone make that progression to forms of pornography that are illegal?
It's because what they have looked at doesn't satisfy. OR has heard me say this so much it's almost a cliche. If one image could satisfy, one would have just that single photograph. But it requires picture after picture, video after video, deeper and darker, different, always trying to fill that hole that cannot be filled by that image, because it's no way that the photograph or the video can provide intimacy. But with the immature mindset and immature sexuality, then folks continue to try to have that. We can also see that with folks who don't use pornography. Maybe they go from partner to partner because they think they know what is intimacy, and yet they haven't experienced it. They haven't taken it beyond the sexual activity.
A lot of the issue, too, is that I believe that because of the Internet and things that Covenant Eyes is doing, I think is so important in that Covenant Eyes, I believe, understands that the pornography industry and the images are escalating so quickly. You know, it's almost like I went from one level to that level that was illegal in about 3-4 years. It's just like I got on a treadmill that was fed up, that was running at its top speed. And I think a lot of that was because, again, there seems to be within the pornography industry competition to see who can gross out the other side. And I think we all know that's just going to continue to be worse and worse, that industry struggles with how they have a business model. The only way to get more customers is to do things that somebody else doesn't do. So I think that's part of it also, is just that we're getting so saturated that to find something new, it gets more and more and more bizarre.
Hindsight is, you know, 2020, and you've been married now for around 40 years or so, and you've been with your husband through all of this and had many conversations with him about his addiction since this discovery, since all this stuff came unraveled. Knowing what you know now, how do you see that his pornography use impacted your marriage, even before you knew about it?
Well, we never truly emotionally connected until it was out of his life. There was just always a distance and a coldness in the relationship and a void in my life, because I never really felt like I really and truly knew him. He would lie and manufacture reasons why he had to be away from me, and that was before the Internet came into play. And then after the Internet made it available in our home, he would slip away and spend hours in his office away from me. And it took time and energy away from us, precious time that we could have spent together, because he was a traveling man. And so I felt robbed.
I mean, I don't know how many times, especially in the early days of the Internet, I would get into that deal like Dr. O'Quinn's talking about, looking for that perfect image. And I'd get on the computer, and I'd start at 9:30 at night. And before I know it, I look, and it's 2 in the morning, and I'm still on the computer, and I've got to be up at 5 o'clock to catch a plane the next day to go to another city. So, I mean, I cheated everybody and stole from everyone.
I also remember, O.R., you telling me that there were some times that you didn't go to bed at all.
Yeah, I just have to... I'd work through the night and then realize too wired up again from all this, and then just literally laying in bed from the guilt, and again that whole guilt cycle, and it's just a vicious circle.
Well, as part of the therapy, O.R. had to look that his primary victim was Brenda, and while there is the objectification and the hardship of the models that are in the pornography, the person that he hurt the most was Brenda. Second was himself, because he didn't find the fulfillment that she was willing to offer him through her love of him. And what's remarkable is that her love is so strong that she stayed with him through all this.
Yeah.
Finally, they have the type of relationship that you can admire.
So in the midst of all this, as you guys have been working through these things, and I know there's probably 1,000 details to the story that could come out, but one of the prevailing themes that I keep hearing from you, RR, is this theme of secrecy. You, before the days of the Internet, took great care to try to hide your actions from other people, creating excuses, stories, lies, fabricating scenarios so you could get yourself alone to look at pornography, or put yourself in a position where you weren't around other people to look at pornography. Then, of course, the Internet made that even more available, more anonymous.
And that was also one of the motivations for O.R.
Yeah.
was that he had this secret life. He could play I Have a Secret.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so part of his therapy, coming clean and talking to Brenda, admitting, yes, he came to see me, but it really started once he started telling the truth and not hiding anymore.
Yeah, let me tell you a story that happened to me as a teenager. My parents, and I love my parents, but they came from a different generation. They did their best, but they caught me with a pornographic book one time, and their way of dealing with that was to take the pictures and post them on the wall of the kitchen to embarrass me. So what did I learn from that? Hmm. Well, I learned to be much better at hiding so that they wouldn't find the darn things next time. So I got to where, you know, that was kind of one of those lessons. Okay, I didn't learn to stop the action, but I learned to be much more clever. And I followed that through my entire life.
Right.
Until this came about. And Brenda had to suffer through that because of the fact that I was so good at being secretive. And I mean, Jim knows I'm a pretty good salesman. I was very good at trying to hide. And I hid this from my church, too. Mm. And that was part of the sadness of this. That I was a leader in a church. And here, all this came out on the local news and hurt the people in my church, too.
And so for you, how has accountability played a role in the changes you've made in your life?
Well, Jim talks about justice a lot. And so what I've tried to do is make accountability a matter of justice, that Brenda has the ability and the right at any time to come over to my computer, look at anything on the computer. We love Covenant Eyes. It allows me to do the work that I need to do on the computer, but at the same time, she gets that printout. And I can tell you, if there's anything on that printout that has any question at all, she asks tough questions. That's one of the challenges that I have within my church family is finding someone that will hold me accountable, that wants to talk about these things. You spoke earlier in the interview of how people don't want to talk about this. That's one of my struggles, that I find that people I go to church with, they're fine about talking about this at the 30,000-foot level, but when you go to the person-to-person level at a restaurant or in a coffee house to talk about your struggles, they are so uncomfortable talking about this, even if you're trying to do it in a respectful way, that people just don't want to deal with it.
Dr. Quinn, you link this concept to the idea of justice. How so?
Well, justice, because it's doing the right thing, and you can't have accountability until you work toward justice. A concept in my theology is called restorative justice, that you're working toward making as right as possible how a wrong situation was. And so you restore back the balance. The justice is doing the right thing, and you can look at that biblically, you can look at that within civil law, you can look at that relationally. That there is an element of justice. Justice is not the scales, but doing the right thing. From my foundation, it is grounded in the justice that God provides, that yes, you are guilty, but this is the antidote to your sin. So to live a life aimed toward justice is that you are working toward being worthy of the repentance and worthy of the salvation that has been given to you.
My religious background is very much a works-oriented background, and I've found that I can't be good enough. I can't say no, no, no to myself enough. The way to freedom in this from pornography was loving my Lord enough, and then loving Brenda and loving my family enough to realize what I did to each of them when I did these things. So I try and use not guilt as a negative thing, but the real reality that all of us are guilty of sin, and that I do not want that sin to be back in my life, because I value my relationship with my wife and my children, and because of the depth of hurt, I know I'm not allowed an uh-oh. You know, I've got to stay clean of this particular sin.
When I found out about the his porn usage. It felt so much like adultery that I just had to put down my foot and draw a line in the sand and say, from this point forward, our life is going to be different if you're going to be with me. And we put controls on the TV channels. We heard about the Covenant Eyes program and put that on the computer. And all of those things that we put into place, for a while he couldn't go to public places without a partner with him, whether it was someone from church or myself or one of our kids with him. It just made his life transparent, and it made it where I didn't have to be the cop. I could just focus on being his wife and trying to get better myself. That's the only way you can build trust in a relationship, is it's first built on honesty and transparency and mutual respect.
You have been listening to our interview with O.R. and Brenda Leslie and Dr. Jim O'Quinn. Learn more about their ministry, Three Voices, by contacting them at bleslie@leslieconsultants.com or calling 804-248-8668. O.R., Brenda, and Dr. Jim are currently visiting various churches and schools to give their presentation, Pornography's Effect on the Family. I am your host, Luke Gilkerson. Listen to more of our podcasts by visiting Covenant Eyes Radio on iTunes or visit the Covenant Eyes blog, Breaking Free, at covenanteyes.com/blog.